And murders in large numbers is the core of the book, The Poisoner's Handbook. Deborah Blum is the author. She's also a professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and an author of a book called Ghost Hunter. She also won a Pulitzer Prize, damn it. You know, I guess I should have put that up in the first line. Anytime somebody wins a Pulitzer Prize, that should be right after their name. And so it is, though, that she's written an amazing book about murder during the Jazz Age in New York. And I was leafing through a couple of books that I was interested in reading, and I saw this one referenced, and I went to find it and had to have her on. And it is not just a book about what things were like, but also what things are like for us now as a result. We'll talk about that. The number of people that used to get away with murder every day just because there was no forensic medicine to catch them. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. The Pulitzer Prize winning Deborah Blum, the Poisoner's Handbook. Good evening, Deborah.
Good evening.
What did you
Great
do with
to
your
be
pool?
Here.
Thank you. What'd you do with your Pulitzer Prize? Do you wear it around your neck?
I wish I could, but you know, they didn't give you anything so beautiful as that. It's a piece of paper and a paperweight.
I take that paperweight. I put it on a big rope. If you're going out to, if you're throwing out the garbage, going down to the 7-Eleven, you throw on your Pulitzer Prize. The Poisoner's Handbook. Boy, what such interesting work! And I've dog-eared so many pages I want to get to tonight. And I loved how you set this up, which is that each chapter is another poison. But before we get there, let's throw out a couple of sort of bigger issues that come up both from your research in the past and also what it means for us today. It's odd for me as I was reading this, I kept thinking how rare it is that at least it seems like there are serial poisoners in society today. I mean, I was thinking of very few cases like the Tylenol murder case and a couple other places, a couple of limited things like that. But mostly we don't have serial poisoners anymore, right?
No, that's right. At least very rarely. And the Tylenol example you gave, is a good one and sort of, about 30?
Yeah, 30 years ago. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I really do credit the advances in forensics for that. With the period I looked at, which was early 20th century, poisons were so easy to get, and scientists were still struggling to figure out how to detect them, that it opened the way for people to really go on kind of poison sprees that you don't see anymore, thank goodness.
Yeah, but I think, and just to that point about the availability of poisons, there certainly are lots of things that we can buy at a corner grocery store that can kill us. And there are rat poisons, and there are, there's Drano and all sorts of stuff, but it isn't like it used to be where they were the sort of the purer, easier to dissolve, harder to detect forms of poison that were ubiquitous.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, when you go back to the 1920s, you find, for instance, that arsenic is in cosmetic preparations or the kind of rat poison that you would find at the corner grocery store, and cyanide is floating around. People used it to polish silver. They used it in photo processing, and mercury is a fairly common prescription medicine. So it was really easy to get your hands on something that was a tricky poison that was often hard to detect. Not cyanide. Cyanide's easy to detect.
Right.
And to go out with it.
But that would be, again, it would be easy. It's hard to imagine quite the day when poisons would be so easy to find. They would be so hard to detect. They would be in a purified form. We have them still in products, but it makes it for the person who is about to be poisoned. There are many more clues that there's something in the food or something that's in the drink than there was, say, as recent as 80 years ago in this country.
That's right. And it's interesting to me because a lot of the research I did, I was looking at newspapers and magazines of the time, and you find something that you just don't see in society today, which is a general level of fearfulness about being poisoned. For instance, Yeah, I was surprised at how many times people were poisoned by getting poisoned gifts in the mail.
Right.
A person would lose their job and be angry at the person who took it, and a nice little box of cyanide-laced chocolates would show up. There was a one case I looked at. There was a neighbor angry at her neighbor. The dogs barked too much, and she snuck out in the morning and poisoned her neighbor's milk. There was a very nasty woman. My call, I think she was nasty. She really did not want to have a stepchild, and she mailed her stepson, who was 12, some candy poisoned with mercury, I believe, and the little boy didn't need it, but his aunt did. So you see this kind of sort of social awareness that poisons are really handy and that I can use them in all these ways. And I'm very grateful not to live in a time where people thought that way so easily.
Or even in, there's a famous case of this in your book, and we'll get to more of the cases of the Poisoner's Handbook, but of somebody that just sent a medicine in the mail in a box that said, "Here, drink this." And the guy, not every case did it work, but that bottle was actually kept, that somebody didn't just throw that out. We live in an age now where if somebody said that, we might even call the FBI. I'd like call the postal service right away. We live in a very a much more suspicious time than they did back then, where people would have been like, "Okay, I'll eat it."
Right, they go, wow, cool present. And
Right.
one of the cases early in the turn of the century in New York was a man. He was actually the son of a Civil War general, Leslie Molyneux, and just every time someone crossed him, apparently, his response was to get rid of them. And the way he would do it was that he would go out and kind of buy a nice fancy bottle. He actually bought one at Tiffany's and then would send the beautiful little bottle holder and some medicine with it. And in one case, this man, one man died, and the other one, his aunt had a headache, and he gave her the medicine, and she died. And you're absolutely right. If we got a package in the mail that said from a well-wisher or just Merry Christmas from whoever, we would not be go chugging down that medicine. We're more suspicious than that, and I don't believe in being completely paranoid in every minute, but yeah, don't drink
Right.
the anonymous bottle that comes
Right.
in the mail. That's a bad idea.
Now, chocolate chip cookies sent to me at the radio station, that really is a different thing. And
Oh,
I don't know that I've ever passed up.
totally.
I probably shouldn't after reading this book. All right, so but then there was the other aspect of this, which again, it speaks to why fewer people get away with or even attempt poisoning today, like they used to. It was not just the availability, it was not just the delivery method, but it was also the people that were out there determining whether or not poisons had been used. And I want to read a paragraph for your book, okay? I won't do it justice to the way a Pulitzer Prize writer wrote it, but I'll do my best. The city required no, we're talking about New York City here, required no medical background or training for coroners, even though they were charged with determining the cause of death. The list of the New York City coroners from 1898 to 1915 included 8 undertakers, 7 politicians, 6 real estate dealers, 2 saloon keepers, 2 plumbers, a lawyer, a printer, an auctioneer, a wood carver, a carpenter, a painter, a butcher, a marble cutter, a milkman, an insurance agent, a labor leader, and a musician. These were the people who were the coroners in New York City. Come on, no wonder they didn't catch anybody.
Don't you love that? And the other thing to me that was so amazing was when I was sort of trolling around in the death certificates of the time period. So it wasn't just that these guys had no medical training, but they hadn't even bothered to kind of read the books, and you would find as cause of death act of God,
Right.
or you would find, these were my favorite, the one where the coroner just was like, could be this or maybe not. So
Could
you
be
see that?
suicide, could be murder, could be
Yes.
illness. Well, thank
Could be
you.
diabetes, could be an
Could be
auto
diabetes,
accident.
right. Could be an
Right.
auto accident. I mean, it was crazy. And then there was like a whole cottage industry of these hacks, these political appointee hacks, these Tammany Hall, you know, payback jobs that these guys were getting. And there was a whole side business they were doing, selling blank death certificates out the back door.
Yes, you could buy your cause of death. I mean, it was one of the reasons that Tammany Hall, which was the big Democratic Party machine in New York around then, regarded this as such a wonderful way to reward someone who is loyal to the machine, is you could make a lot of money being a coroner. You could give the family any kind of cause of death they wanted. And there was one coroner, as I remember, you charge the city for every body you looked at, who just sort of dipped a body in and out of the Hudson River several times and charged the city for each time.
I think it wrote down seven times that the guy moved the body, dropped it back in the river, and pulled it out seven times.
Yes, he got very rich off this one poor dead guy. And so you can see that when people started saying, wouldn't it be great to have someone qualified? There were a lot of people
idea.
Going, no.
Right. There was lots of people saying, no, bad idea, bad idea.
Yeah.
And some of the people who were saying bad idea were the affluent and probably the influential in the sense of making political contributions, who kind of liked the system because they were more inclined to use poison to knock off somebody for their inheritance.
Yes. In fact, in what people call the golden age of poisoners, which is probably from the sort of the late 18th century all the way to the early 20th, the poison arsenic was used so commonly that its nickname was the inheritance powder. It was just like, this person is in the way of me getting
right.
rich a little quicker, and no big deal because I'm going to get away with it. In that sense, it was a very scary time.
Well, and it wasn't, what didn't one of the poisons also have a nickname that went back to like a Latin motto or an Italian a phrase for knocking off mom, or what was it? I can't, there was a...
Oh, puta de sucesión.
Yeah, what is that?
That's another way of saying inheritance powder. Actually.
Inheritance powder, right. So that wasn't like a recent expression. That was an old expression.
That's right.
So
people have a lot of faith in arsenic.
Yeah, exactly. So here you have it. We're just trying to set up the idea of what happens during this period from, let's say, 1890s into post-World War I, where things started to get real. And New York set the standard. Other cities began to follow to have real pathologists, people with experience to compete for the jobs, to get the best person in the job, to try to put an end to the incentive that was out there for murderers to roam free. And it's not just somebody who was, putting mom's suffering to an end. It wasn't a matter of somebody concerned about, well, so-and-so could hang on for another 3 months, but let's go ahead and take it. There were serial killers that were, or spree killers at least, who were poisoning batches of food, presumably for nothing else other than sport.
That's right. In fact, there was this guy, his name was James Baker, and he called himself Texas Jim, and he actually had packed a briefcase full of different kinds of poison, and he would get on the railroads and ride them until he was kind of bored and get off and go into coffee shops and then strike up a conversation and sneak a little poison into the coffee of whoever he was idly chatting to. And when they finally caught him after he had killed 10 people, he told the police he just loved the experiment. He liked to see how these different poisons worked. He wanted to watch.
Well, and that's not terribly different. I mean, it's sort of weird to put it in the same context, but I kept thinking about the play Arsenic and Old Lace.
Yes.
I mean, there were two old ladies, and they were knocking off lonely old men who were coming to live at their boarding home. And, you know, they just kind of felt like they were doing them a favor. I mean, we think of it as sort of the funny, kooky kind of Addams Family kind of a gag to it, but it was actually fairly consistent with what some people felt they had a right to do. Like the guy that was poisoning people that he was charged to take care of in that sanatorium. He wasn't arsenic. What was he using?
It was chloroform.
Chloroform. Yeah. Well, that brings us to chloroform. Let's start there, because the way that the Poisoner's Handbook is broken down chapter by chapter, we learn about this particular period, and we learn about how the authorities began to answer to this dilemma by creating a real effective medical examiner's office and the birth of the CSI lab, which we'll get to coming up. But the chloroform was very interesting, because when I think of chloroform, you know, I think of the classic, you know, sort of film noir thing where a detective walks into a room and somebody comes up with a rag and knocks him out for a second. I didn't realize that it was more than just something people used as a temporary anesthetic or something that somebody used just for knockout drops. It was a poison, and it was used all the time because it was very effective.
That's right. I mean, it was kind of, when I was started the book, and I started with chloroform because this was a serial killer who completely confessed and still was able to walk away. I wanted to look at that dilemma where you have someone who uses poison, and even though you know that they're the killer, you can't prove it. And chloroform was really interesting to me. It was actually invented in the mid-19th century by doctors. They were looking, you know, for some drugs that would make surgery less painful. And as it became popular, you saw this whole kind of interesting rush by the sort of criminal underworld to make use of it. It was the most popular way to do home invasion robberies. People would knock on your door, you'd answer the door, they'd slap a chloroform-soaked rag over your face and go in and take everything you had. And it was kind of incredible to me. People did it on trains. There was actually someone at a party who chloroformed his guests and then took all their wallets. So, I mean, it was wildly used, and it was, as doctors had discovered when they used it as an anesthetic, really, really poisonous.
It was unreliable because you could use it in either liquid form or powder form. But either way, you could one dose to the same small dose you might have given to a large person would kill them. And that you gave the same dose to a smaller, slighter person and they were fine. There wasn't any real easy way to work out chloroform. Well, that's where we'll start when we pick up with the Poisoner's Handbook. About chloroform, we'll talk about one of the more famous chloroform killers that was out there, and he turned himself in, and they couldn't get a conviction. That's part of the frustration of the Poisoner's Handbook. Of the two or three cases that Deborah Blum has already mentioned, none of them ended in convictions because they didn't have the science to back up the legal claims, the, in some case, obvious evidence that this was murder. And we'll talk more about the birth of the CSI lab that comes along with the Poisoner's Handbook next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, in enjoying all of the postings on my Facebook page, too. Thank you, everybody. If you go online at coasttocoastam.com, I put up a blog about some of the stories that are appearing at coasttocoastam.com, including that jetpack story. Way cool. And a couple of links of some things that people had sent to me during the week at that Facebook page. And I'm enjoying that quite a bit. Although I'm not, as I mentioned last night, I'm not doing Farmville or Mafia Wars, which are these social network games going around. I would, however, do Mafiaville and Farm Wars, if anybody ever came up with those. Or I might even play Mafia Wars if I could bury the bodies on Farmville. But until that point, I'm out. And there's a reason, too, why we are living in a time when more people commit horrible acts using guns and knives than they used to, because a lot of the options are just eliminated. There used to be a lot more people out there that were getting away with murder using poison. Fortunately, that's not the case, but the time when the tide turned against poisoners is recounted in the book, The Poisoner's Handbook. We'll talk about chloroform and arsenic and cyanide coming up, and then see what other ones we can get to before the night is over with Deborah Blum next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Deborah Blum, the author of The Poisoner's Handbook. We'll talk more about the scientific response to the poisonings first, but let's talk about that guy whose name meant death. The guy who seemed like he came to this country just to poison people. The guy Moores, is that his name?
Yes, Frederick Moores, and that had not been his name in Europe, but when he came to the United States, he changed it to Moores, which in Latin refers to death, and actually lived up to his name.
And his intent was, he turned himself in, and his intent was to stop him. I mean, it seemed like he was, nobody else had caught on to the fact that he was poisoning people in a rest home. Nobody else seemed particularly bothered by it. And then they were, the first reaction is, well, the guy must not be telling the truth.
You know, it's interesting because there were so few, when I went back and looked, a lot of people refer to him as one of the first serial killer investigations in New York. He was working at combined retirement home orphanage in the Bronx, and he had killed, by his own count, about 8 people when he finally felt he was running out of control, walked into the police station dressed in his best clothes, and confessed. And their first reaction was, well, this just couldn't be true. No one goes around killing 8 people and then confesses.
Right, that part threw them, and then confesses.
Right. So their first thought is, well, he must be crazy. They went out to the home, and sure enough, they discovered that one by one, the elderly people in his care had been dropping dead. And in fact, there was evidence from some of the other people who worked there that some of these deaths were very mysterious. Actually, even evidence that he might have been using chloroform, because chloroform with it, like if you put a chloroform soaked rag on someone's skin, it's actually fairly caustic and you get burns. And some of the people he had killed had these chloroform burns around their mouths. So they had a lot of evidence, but they were actually, their investigation was totally screwed up by the coroner, who was convinced that there was no way to prove a chloroform killing.
And then they, long story short with him, they can't get a conviction.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I did when I looked at it is I just said to myself, you have these statements from the coroner saying there's absolutely no way we can find chloroform in a dead body. Absolutely no way. So I went and looked at the scientific texts of the time, and sure enough, there were really good tests for finding chloroform in a dead body. But based on the fact that they had their leading, you know, quote, medical expert assuring them there was no way to prove this, they never charged him formally with any of these murders.
Well, they put him in a home for the insane for a while, but they couldn't really, since they didn't have a conviction and he wasn't considered criminally insane, he just eventually got bored and left.
He walked away. The head of the home said, well, you never said he was dangerous. This isn't a place for criminals.
Right. And so who knows how many more people he poisoned in his life?
You do wonder that. And, you know, in fact, there were other serial poisoners. There was a woman in Indiana who had killed 40 people. She used to advertise on the Lonely Hearts columns, right? You know,
right.
Beautiful widow, seeks good-looking companion on lush and valuable farm, and she actually would invite them over for dinner, knock them out with chloroform again, and then give them a little strychnine. And she She also got away with it. And when they caught up with her about 30 years later, she had just killed someone else. So these guys who got away with it and went on the road, I've wondered myself how many people they did away with.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, like the founder of Rice University, sometimes there was an apparent motive where it really was, you know, there was money involved and there were family issues or there was whatever. But a lot of the times it just seemed like it was what we would account today as a thrill killing.
There were a lot of thrill killings, but I'm glad you mentioned Rice University, because one of the things that struck me when I was going back and looking as I was thinking, I didn't realize how many fairly well-known people were poisoned. But, you know, there was another poisoning that I didn't do because mine was so East Coast-centered, but Jane Stanford, the wife of Leland Stanford, who founded Stanford University, was poisoned by strychnine.
That's right.
In a very mysterious case.
I've heard that.
People suspected the president of the university.
Yeah, I heard that story. That's interesting because that's Rice University and Stanford University.
It was very dangerous to found a university.
Okay, apparently. Yeah. And your book is, you know, sort of New York centered, but I think that is to New York's credit at the time that they really were on the cutting edge. They were moving beyond the little fiefdoms of these Tammany Hall appointments, and they were actually trying to create a higher standard for determining when a poisoning had happened. Because if they hadn't, well, then who knows where we would be today? I mean, if really, how many more people would just be sort of, you'd almost have to have walk around with a food taster and not just one, like two or three of them. I mean, there was just that much going on.
And that was one of the reasons I, you know, kind of centered the book in New York, was because they're really inventing forensic medicine there. And I'm fascinated by the power of a few people to change the world as these forensic scientists did. But I see it as, you know, as a book. I don't see it as a book for just people who live in New York.
No,
book about poison and murder.
No, I think it's totally fair. But it is, it's very universal, but it's sort of like a lab. I mean, we're watching a city dealing with an issue, and it's compelling. So that chloroform, we can talk more about all of the different poisons, but it's great in the book. Again, every chapter is a different poison. So let's move on to from chloroform to arsenic, because I think arsenic is that poison that so many people think of as sort of the main culprit, although it's not. I mean, there's many other ones out there, but arsenic is big. Oh, and I suppose we should mention wood alcohol too, because that was one I think it has become, that's just not one that's commonly associated with something that's in up the poisoner's sleeve.
Right, and wood alcohol or methyl alcohol is really poisonous. One of my first jobs, I was a police reporter up in the Appalachia in North Georgia, and it was really easy then to get your hands on what we called white liquor or moonshine. And a lot of the firefighters in these little fire stations where I used to hang out had white liquor. And they were really specific about the fact that you had to know your shiner, because it was really easy to get poisonous moonshine. And so when we're talking about wood alcohol, that's really what it was. And one of the things about my book is that I'm setting it in the era of prohibition, where the U.S. government is massively restricting trade and alcohol. It's illegal to distribute it. It's supposed to be impossible to get. And immediately you see this whole sort of criminal enterprise and home enterprise of people making their own liquor. And a lot of this liquor was just really lethal. So I wanted to look at that factor in prohibition. I wanted people to see how poison sort of swam through society at this time, and that one of them was basically your home brew.
I've smelled this kind of hooch before. I've never tasted it. I'm not a drinker. I lived in North Georgia for a while, but I didn't come across moonshine until I did 3 weeks in with a Christian mission group in Eastern Kentucky. And somebody that we were working with said, we were talking casually about moonshine. He goes, oh, do you want to smell that? And I said, yeah, I'm kind of curious. He goes, oh, it's awful. And he said, it'll kill you, but half the time. And then he went and he proceeded to go get some in a mason jar. I don't know where he got it from, but he hadn't been gone that long. And he came back with a mason jar full of moonshine. And he said, here, he wanted to see the look on my face when I smelled it. And it smelled like paint thinner. Mm-hmm. And I understand it. It could be used as paint thinner. And this is the kind of alcohol which people literally kind of risked their lives with every time they sampled it during Prohibition. And the word was out that it would kill you. And people were still drinking it.
Isn't that incredible? You know, I asked myself about it. One of the things that I found really fascinating is that a lot of the kind of, you know, fancy foo-foo cocktails that we see today that have fruit juices mixed in or different flavorings were really invented in the 1920s to hide the taste of this very raw alcohol. And even though I think there was something about the period, you had this enormous defiance of a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment, which prohibited trade in alcohol. In New York City, in the 1920s, 30,000 speakeasies, these little secretive illegal bars, go into business. People are drinking constantly, and there was like this element of risk and anarchy and defiance in the air. One of the reasons that it's such a fascinating period. And even though people were dying not only of this wood alcohol, but of all the other bizarre things they drank, there was a cocktail in New York called Smoke, which was made of fuel alcohol and water, and it would turn
That's
a cloudy
crazy.
Gray.
That's
and
crazy.
It killed, like, several people every day in New York City, and still people drank it.
Well, what was the statistic in your book of wood alcohol deaths, one a day?
Yeah.
I mean, just from drinking, and not even, you don't have to even drink a lot of it for it to kill you, because so much of it was just poison.
It's really poisonous, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on from there. But it is an interesting piece of history that is largely forgotten. But then so is the time when you could buy arsenic, just pure powdered arsenic, pretty much anywhere. And people used it for all sorts of different things. Wasn't there arsenic was even in certain cures, like hand lotions and stuff that people used as medicine.
That's right. And women used to. It's very stylish to have a kind of pale skin. So there was a over-the-counter, really, solution. It was called Fowler's solution that women would take, and it would make their faces, you know, very pale and ethereal-looking, which was actually because they were, you know, suffering a low grade of poisoning, and they got pale. And there was white arsenic, which was in a powder, and it was used in all kinds of different things, lots of readily available commercial rat poisons. It was used in weed killers. It was used, some people thought arsenic could even be a kind of little pick-me-up. It was in some tonics. You could send your kids down to the corner drugstore to buy a little arsenic solution. I mean, it was really out there at that time and easy to take advantage of.
Well, and yet, then, too, people were able to murder with it. What do you think? I know this is kind of a tough question to answer, but in your research, any indication how many serial killers were going, were suspected but not being prosecuted for lack of physical evidence in New York during this period?
That's a really good question. You know, I focused on one case of at least an arsenic mass murderer in 1922 to give an example of how difficult it was at the time to catch these people. And this was a man, I'm saying a man, although we don't really know. So the suspects were mostly men in this case, but there was a little restaurant that operated on Broadway, and it was a lunch place. And one day, one night, someone went down to the restaurant kitchen. They had a big bowl of dough that they were keeping overnight for the next day's lunch. They were going to make, you know, pies and rolls and all kinds of things, and stirred white arsenic into it. And the next day, they served lunch, and they had just a complete poison breakdown. People were crawling back to their offices. 6 people died. 70 people went to the hospital. They had a massive police investigation. They never caught this guy, couldn't figure out, because here's the problem. You can get arsenic anywhere, right?
Right.
So they couldn't say, well, let's trace that arsenic back to the source when there were so many places that sold arsenic in the city. No one had watched him do it. And so in the end, they actually had to close that case without ever finding it. I mean, it was a great example of, in this time, how difficult it was for someone to be a serial poisoner, how easy it was to be a serial poisoner, I guess, and get away with it.
Right. And arsenic being one of them. Now, I want to get to cyanide coming up, another chapter in the Poisoner's Handbook, and then we'll take some broader stroke about the amount of poisons that were just in the environment of the era, and how many of those poisons are with us today, too, if you don't mind me asking. Deborah Blum is a professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin, and also the author of a book I have to ask you about real quickly. Tell me about Ghost Hunters. What's that book about?
Oh, that's still one of my favorite things I did, but that's it's called Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. And I was looking at, I love these moments in history that kind of change the way we think. So I was looking at this period where you had some of the best scientists in the world trying to prove that there's life after death. And what I wanted to look at was, if these are the best scientists in the world on a ghost hunt, what did they find? That's really what that book's about.
Oh, that sounds like another night we'll have to spend with Deborah Blum sometime in the future. But right now it's the Poisoner's Handbook. And we'll also get into more details about how they developed the first CSI lab. With the amount of people who are dropping dead from poisons one way or another in New York, you'd think they'd have funding for this, but they had to scrape it together themselves. It's a long way from what CSI looks like now, but it changed everything. And we'll talk about some of the early successful prosecutions, the people they actually did catch who were serial or spree poisoners. We'll get to that next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.